Hang on a second. Okay, our speaker, Thomas, will now share his experience for 20 minutes on the mental obsession. And would you like me to give you a 5-minute warning?
Yes, please. That would be great.
Okay, go ahead. It's all yours.
Thanks, Sandy. So my name's Thomas. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm a recovering fixer, controller, chaos creator, and lust addict. And yeah, I thought I'd share briefly about me, where I am first, before getting into this part of the book in step one. My first program was Al-Anon. I came in to Al-Anon about 10 years ago, just over 10 years ago. I'm also a member of AA. I've also visited CODA and codependent and other programs too. But the programs I'm in now are Al-Anon and AA. And I mostly participate in Big Book Awakening meetings because what I find here is what the book talks about. I find a fellowship where we all have a solution that we can absolutely, a way out that we can absolutely agree on. And I don't always find that in other meetings in my fellowships. Here I find people really on a spiritual path to finding their own answers with the help of this BBA process, and to living sober, fulfilled, happy, joyous, and free lives, free from the bondage of self. Although we come from different fellowships, it's extraordinary how I really feel in BBA there is a kind of unity based on that we're really working the principles of the 12 steps as found in the Big Book. We have this method that we all use and can share about. And I hear so much recovery in these rooms. I get so many ideas and so much encouragement. I first did the BBA steps. When did we start? I did a workshop with some other, it was a men's only workshop with about 5 other guys. And it was in 2017 to 2018. So that's when I worked through the steps, when I did this part of the book. I haven't made all my amends yet, but I've made some of them. And I'm due another go through, really. In any case, that's where I am. I'm not an expert on the Big Book or BBA. But yeah, I did find some things that strike me about this section of the book, which is the first half of more about alcoholism, chapter 3, that I'd like to share with you. This chapter really, it's what struck me looking at it again is how it really hammers home the seriousness of our condition, whether we're alcoholic, drug addict, excitement addict, food addict, sex and love addict, whatever our addictions are, as it says here, we're asked to write in by the workbook. This chapter talks about most of us being unwilling to admit we were real addicts. And it says here, we're still looking at what goes on in my mind with respect to alcohol or adrenaline or food, whatever it is, without my drug in my system. So the way it was explained to me in the 3 parts of step one, there's the physical craving, the mental obsession, and the spiritual malady. And if I have the physical craving, that means when I take one drink of whatever my drink of choice is, I will crave more, and I lose control over how much I take. And the mental obsession tells me that on my own power, by my own means or any other means and spiritual means, I will always drink again. It doesn't matter how long I manage to quit for. It doesn't matter what safety nets I put in place. It doesn't matter how much self-knowledge I have, how much knowledge I have about being addicted. The mental obsession means I'll always go back to my drug unless I'm protected by a higher power and my spiritual malady is being healed. So we're really being fenced in here by step one. There's no way out. And on the, you know, on the first page of this chapter, it puts it in no uncertain terms. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics or excitaholics or addicts. No person likes to think he or she is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. At that part, that's a sentence that really gets me. I'll probably spend most of the time on this first page because so much of it's driving. If I'm being honest, I still really don't like to think that I'm bodily and mentally different from other people. I want to be normal. I want to find a way that I don't have to go to these meetings and do this program, and I can just manage life on my own like a normal, mature, respectable adult. This whole idea is a delusion, which is a word that is used later, but it's you know, no one likes to think that we're bodily and mentally different. So if I'm saying that I'm an addict, that means I'm saying that I am bodily and mentally different from other people. So since nobody likes admitting this, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. So I still do this today, with chaos creating, the adrenaline addiction, the addiction to the internal drugstore, it's more difficult to know if I've slipped, if I'm slipping into a binge, than with alcohol, obviously. But I think the similarity, and that comes up in these examples here in this chapter, is that because of the mental obsession, I can start taking my drug again, my drug of choice again, whether it's alcohol or anything else, without realizing, before I've even realized that I'm doing it, before I've even realized, or even with the attention not to. And that happens to me with my chaos creating and with my fixing and controlling. These vain attempts to prove I can manage my life like other people, I can cope with stress like other people, I can pile on the stress and then just manage it like other people, make excuses, unwind in the evening like other people, relax like other people. And almost every day, I come up against the temptation to get back into that again. I need to use the program every day to keep close to God, to keep maintain my spiritual condition, if I'm not to get back into it. The idea that somehow someday he or she will control and enjoy their drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. So if I have this idea that someday I'll be able to control it, that just means I'm a common or garden alcoholic or addict of any kind. it's a really tricky proposition. It's saying that part of the disease, the book is saying that part of the disease is that I'm convinced I don't have it, or I'll try anything to prove I don't have it, which is one form of insanity, really. We learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics or that we were addicts. Have I fully conceded to my innermost self that I'm an addict? What does that mean? It means I'm bodily and mentally different from other people. It says this is the first step in recovery. So we know the first step. We admitted we were powerless. Our lives have become unmanageable. But this is it. In other words, we had to fully concede, fully admit defeat. We had to fully concede to our innermost selves. What does innermost self mean to me? That means without one part of me holding out and thinking, yeah, I'm going to say this in the meeting, but I'm going to keep an open mind. Maybe I'm not a real alcoholic, or maybe I'm not a real addict. I'm just going to go with it. It says here that's not enough to take step one. We have to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were addicts. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. Presently, in the English of this time, means soon. The delusion that we are like other people, or soon maybe, at some point in the future maybe, has to be smashed. And smashed, this was pointed out recently by another speaker that I heard on the book. In fact, on this section of the book, I think, smashed is a carefully chosen word here. It means, you know, it's beyond repair. This delusion has to be destroyed completely. So that's the first thing, you know, we're not like other people. And if I'm clinging to the idea that maybe I can be like other people, then I'm not done with step one. And here's the next this is really a blow, I think. We alcoholics and men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. I've lost the ability to control, my body, my mind. Speaking as, you know, a fixer controller, chaos creator, our body, a normal body and mind, is regulated and triggers hormones when they're needed in appropriate situations. But what's happened with me is that as an addict, I've tried to manage myself and my life and the people around me to such an extent that I can't control whether I do it or not on my own power. And I've also got into a situation where I've created situations in my life unconsciously in order to get to be adrenalized, to be stressed. Now that's definitely not normal. I've lost the ability to control when and if I do that. So this is pretty devastating if we're appreciating what it means. It's pretty devastating for our addiction. We have lost the ability to control our drinking. No real alcoholic ever recovers control. Do I believe I will ever recover control? These questions are really important. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control. Have I at times felt I was regaining control? Yes, definitely. That still happens to me regularly. Thankfully, I've learned to be vigilant and see it as a red flag. So I can take use a spiritual tool. Such intervals, when we thought we were regaining control, were usually brief and were inevitably followed by a still less control, which led in time to pitiful an incomprehensible demoralization, which sounds awful and is at the time, but is actually good news because, you know, in my experience, when I start to get off course, there's this kind of, you know, my disease and God together will, if I feel I'm regaining control and I start to try to take back control, it's inevitably followed by still less control. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, which leads to the realization that I cannot control this thing on my own. And every time I get a little bit into it again, managing myself again, trying to manage, instead of turning to my new manager, God, it usually hurts sooner or later. And that pushes me back into a deeper relationship with God. Thanks, Sandy. So we are convinced, who is we here? We are convinced to a man, so that means all of us. These are the first nearly 100 alcoholics who recovered with this program, with the 12 steps. They are convinced, every single one of them, that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. So I think those three paragraphs for me and the questions that were asked, they're really important, and they should, well, they do for me kind of hammer home. They didn't at first, you know, because there's still part of me thinking, maybe this isn't quite me, and that's fine. I need to enter step one with a question, not with an answer, you know, as Mark Houston says. If I'm going to have a spiritual experience, I need a question, not an answer. So I'm not trying to say that there's right answers here, because there aren't. We need to honestly ask ourselves these questions and see where it takes us. But here they are talking about, you know, if what a real alcoholic is, what a real addict is. And that's what I am. There's on page 31, which is the second page of this chapter, there's some of the methods people have tried to drink like other people. And, you know, it usually raises a smile when it's read in meetings. Some of the methods we've tried: drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning. All these little rules, that's why people smile, because they've tried it. Drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours. These are all things that didn't work. Drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job. This is the one that I really love: taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever. That's where I get stuck. You know, I know that I'm not in good spiritual condition when I'm worrying about a decision. Or if I do this, I'll feel better. If I don't do this, it'll go wrong. If I do this, if I don't do this, I can try either. It doesn't matter if I'm not in good spiritual condition. I'm going to continue to cause myself and others problems. My addiction is going to continue to progress, and I'm going to continue to suffer from the spiritual malady. So whether I take a trip or whether I don't, it doesn't matter whether I take a trip or whether I don't. It doesn't matter in the sense that it won't get me better, just taking a trip or not taking a trip. But it also doesn't matter once I'm sober. Taking a trip or not taking a trip anywhere in itself isn't particularly going to keep me sober. It's only God that's going to do that in my relationship with God. There were a few other things I wanted to say. There's the example, there's two examples in this bit of the guy who at the age of 30 decided to quit drinking until he'd retired. So he managed to not drink for 25 years. And then as soon as he retired, after a successful career, he allowed himself to start drinking again. And he was dead within 4 years at the age of 59. So obviously this illustrates, it's one example of if I can keep sober on my own power for a particular period of time, it's an example of this obsession that maybe I can do it on my own power. Maybe I can do it on my own power. And in the end, it kills me. And 33. Yeah, there's an important sentence here. To be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time, nor take the quantities some of us have. So for all of us, but particularly anyone new, I mean, anyone of any age can come in and hope that, oh, maybe I'm not as bad as them because I didn't do this, I didn't do that, I didn't get as bad as that. The questions in the BBA process are there to take us to an answer of whether we're an addict or not, regardless of whether we did exactly the same things or got as deep into it as other people. That's not relevant. That's what the point is here. And then 34, it says, for those who are unable to drink moderately, so who have the physical craving, the question is how to stop altogether forever. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. So, important question, do I desire to stop entirely? Whether such a person can stay stopped on a non-spiritual basis by choice depends upon the extent to which they've already lost the power to choose. Many of us felt we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. This utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. It keeps creeping up on us. Sometimes it creeps up on us, sometimes we just do it. And then there's the example of Jim, the famous example. It says, we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. Obviously, this is the crux of the problem. They eventually conclude, you know, if you ask an alcoholic why they drink or not, why they took that first drink, even though they know it'll kill them or could kill them, and that they have the physical craving, most of them will admit they don't know. That's where these examples lead to. What we find out is that we have a spiritual malady, and that's the reason. You know, what Jim does, he's the guy who, he lost his business, someone else bought it, he ended up working for them. He's resentful about this. He goes out on sales calls and he ends up stopping at a diner. And he's been sober for a while. He's been made aware of his condition, the steps, but he hasn't enlarged his spiritual life yet. And he thinks maybe if I put some milk in my whiskey, it'll be okay. And I think it's worth thinking about what would be your equivalent if you're not a drinker. You know, for me, as a fixer controller, it's giving unsolicited advice by pretending I'm talking about myself, you know, like somehow framing it. I want to give this person advice, but I know I shouldn't. So if I somehow tell a story or make up a story about myself, say that it's about me, but I'm still in it, you know, I'm still trying to fix and control. It's only going to lead to more problems.
Time.
The other things I might do, taking on extra work that I know is too much, but making a deal with myself that I'll work extra at the weekend, or staying up too late, but making a deal that I'll have a nap in the afternoon the next day. Always it's about trying to prove that I can manage my life on my own. And that's the obsession for me. Yeah, thanks.
Oh, thanks, Thomas. That was great. I'm going to stop the recording.